info, music, signals, news, fun and frolic, and emergency instructions.
90.7 FM, WGXC.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. This is August Black talking to you from the Wave Farm headquarters. I am the artist in residence this week. The title of my residency is Radio Research, and we're doing experiments in, around, and through a software application I made called Mezcal. Before we get to today's show, I wanted to remind you that there will be two other experiments tomorrow, one happening at 11 a.m. and another at 2 p.m., all here on WGXC. And I look forward to, sending out to you then. Today's broadcast is extra special. We have a one-hour live broadcast called Migrant Detention Radio from the artist Eliseo Ortiz, who is outside the Otay Mesa Detention Center in San Diego, California, and from historian Jessica Ordaz, who is outside the Aurora ICE Processing Center in Denver, Colorado.
Thank you, August. Thank you so much, and welcome to Migrant Detention Radio. My name is Eliseo Ortiz. I'm a visual artist. I was born in Mexico. I'm originally from Mexico, but I have spent a few years in the United States, living in the United States, and I became aware of certain problems associated with border controls. That is, forms to secure territories and populations, and one of those forms of control is the criminalization of migrants and the privatization of migrant detention, which is a pattern. What we're seeing is a pattern in which migrant detention is becoming a business. And so for that reason, I wanted to invite historian Jessica Ordaz. Dr. Ordaz published a book about one of the oldest detention centers in the country, called El Centro Detention Center, which is no longer in operation. It closed in 2017. But through her book, she draws really interesting connections to understand the relationship between the exploitation of migrants and the criminalization of migrants, right? And so the book is really a comprehensive study of the present moment, of what we're experiencing right now in terms of detention, looking at this huge, enormous network of detention centers across the country. And so in conversation with her, we came up with the idea of simultaneously broadcasting from two private detention centers. So right now, I'm standing right outside of Otay Mesa Detention Center in San Diego, really close to the border. And Jessica right now is at the Aurora ICE Processing Center in the Denver metro area in a locality of Denver called Aurora. And for the next hour, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be asking questions that are open, broad, stimulating, to really think about this in a touching way, to really think about it through our senses, what we're seeing, how we're feeling, and ultimately connect that to a broader historical context of migrant detention. So thank you so much, Jessica, for being with us. Thank you so much for joining this conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Eliseo, for the introduction and for the invitation. I'm so happy to be with you here.
Awesome. So could you, I guess we're just going to dive into the questions, just like jump straight up. Could you start by telling us about yourself? What is your intellectual or personal connection to migrant incarceration? Why you started to write and investigate about it?
Yeah, so currently I'm an assistant professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And my book recently was published on migrant incarceration, but it's a topic that I focused on for graduate school for my dissertation. So intellectually, I've been working on it for a while. But on a personal level, I do feel comfortable sharing that I am the daughter of migrant workers. I'm the daughter of a father who was apprehended and detained and deported several times at a younger age. And there's been a lot of silence about those experiences. And so my intellectual curiosity really stemmed from those personal connections with the effects of migrant incarceration.
So what we're doing right now is we're walking around the perimeters of these facilities, right? We're right outside of the perimeter of what we are allowed to do. And so I guess the next question, and this is something that we're both going to be answering, but as you walk the perimeter of this facility, how do you feel? Are you afraid or concerned? Do you feel resilient or brave, curious? Why are you here today? Are you against this place? What is the relationship between this place and the landscape of the city where we are? Is the facility invisible to others, to neighbors, to bystanders, to cars, to buses, to drivers, to businesses?
Yeah, so currently I am walking the perimeter of the facility as much as I can. There's definitely a lot of fencing and no trespassing signs. And so to start with your latter question about this location and what that looks like I'm walking towards a train station. So I do think this facility is hidden, but not in the way that others are hidden. For example, maybe you could share a little bit about Otay. But here, like, the Aurora facility sort of blends into the landscape. It's camouflaged, I would argue, as opposed to hidden. It very much looks like a school or a federal building, not necessarily a carceral location or a prison. And in terms of how I'm feeling, I would say, yeah, a little cautious. I don't like to ever get super close because I know that there are a lot of guards and security. And so I guess fear and caution for sure. But also there's just like this weight, right? There's this weight of heaviness, of knowing what has gone on in facilities like the one in Aurora, and that it's hard to know that unless you are familiar with that history. So a sense of heaviness. How about you?
So I guess unlike the facilities that are in urban areas or closer to cities, like the one in Aurora, Otay Mesa is very secluded, right? It's visible, it's accessible. You see the place and you know right away that you're in front of a prison, but it's really far away from the city. So it provides visibility. And the only thing that is between me and the building is a fence, right? A barbed wired fence. So I can actually see the whole building from where I am. I can see its doors, but I feel excluded because the facility is right at the outskirts of San Diego, right? So you have to really drive far away from the city, which is not the case with Aurora, that is really, you know, like in a very centric part of the city. And at the far east from where I'm standing, it's just the foothills of the mountains of San Isidro. So there is nothing else. Like, this is the end of the city. It's among a cluster of warehouses and factories. Like, right across the street, there is a power plant. They just opened a huge Amazon warehouse a few blocks from here. So you can just imagine the context of that in relation to the rest of the city, right?
Wow.
It's definitely scary to be here, I would say, just to respond to the second half of the question. And I feel afraid because I'm alone, and you don't feel that you're like you have a purpose to be here. If you're just standing here, you're doing something, right? So there is like suspicion around it, which again is not the same case in places that are within the city. I think that this is a big factor of how I feel. Like, last time I came, I was told by ICE guards not to trespass the property several times because I didn't really know which were the right places to be. and really doing these broadcasting, these radio broadcasts, is really, you know, like, it feels encouraging because I feel resilient to talk about these things. I feel that we are supported by you guys listening, or whoever is interested and supportive of this cause. So in that way, I feel that we can actually be talking about this in a sort of broader way, in a rigorous way. We can be denouncing the practices of mass incarceration.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So I'm at the point on my walk on the perimeter where I also, like, walked by a lot of warehouses. Ironically, there's a lot of Latinx businesses. Like, I'm seeing a carniceria and a panaderia and a car wash, taxis Latinos. And so it's just very ironic that you wouldn't necessarily know there's a detention center where very horrific things have happened for decades right behind these businesses.
Yeah, and I think that's a very interesting comparison between these two places, right? Because we're talking about one of the biggest, largest complexes, private complexes that have contracts with ICE, with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So this is something that is really interesting because we are looking at two different companies. One of this is Geo Group, which is the one that operates the one in San Diego. And Geo, Core Civic is the one in San Diego, and Geo is the one that is operating the one in Aurora. So these are huge companies that make millions of dollars. So this is also something that we have to be acknowledging about the way that they look, where they constructed this facility, what location they choose to do it, et cetera, et cetera. So, and moreover, the detention centers are really obscured and sealed and almost invisible in certain cases for different reasons, no? Like, there are different strategies involved in obscuring these places, in making them inaccessible. So for example, the place where I am right now, it's a long street that there's a long street, and at the end of that street is a facility, but the street is a dead end. So there is no outlet to get out of this place. And so every car that is driving right now on this street, they're probably heading to the facility. There's no other place to go. So they're probably employees by ICE and whatnot. So that's also something that is interesting about the geography of this place and the reason why it's constructed right at the margins of the city where it's invisible completely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely feel like this violent presence in the architecture and geography of the Aurora Detention Center, in the sense that, and you alluded to this earlier, like, if I get too close, right, and I'm not there to visit someone, I'm not there even to protest, like, I seemingly don't have a purpose and I feel like I'm doing something wrong. Like, I shouldn't be there. And I think the architecture helps with, like, create that feeling.
Right. There are always strategies in why we're one way or another to create that sort of context of criminality, even for the people who are outside doing these kinds of things, right? So this kind of leads to the next question, which is, first of all, how was your drive getting to this place? And secondly, how do you feel about this facility in terms of its stability? Is it grounded? Is it stable? And this is a question that we're asking because the context in which ICE operates these places. So the question is really, would it move or change locations or reappear under different names or change objectives? Would you be able to recognize this facility in the future?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Starting with the drive, though. So the drive for me is only about 15, 16 minutes without traffic, so not far, but seemingly far because I know, like, why I'm coming to Aurora, and so there's a lot attached and associated to that. So whenever I come this way, it does feel further for me than it actually is. In terms of stability and really temporality. So that I find that fascinating because in my research, I found that immigration detention centers, camps, facilities, etc., they often move, right? And like, there's, I'm sure, many that we don't know of because they only were in existence for a handful of years. And then INS, if it's older, more currently ICE, and then they operate new facilities. So for Aurora, this came up for me, and I don't know the answer to it. So the Aurora facility is currently located at 3130 Oakland Street. However, a lot of documents from its operations in the 1980s suggest that it was located at 11901 East 30th Avenue, and it went by a different name before GEO was GEO, when they were Wackenhut Services. So it was the Service INS Processing Center. And I don't know more than that set of information, but I find that really fascinating to think about how having immigration detention centers be temporary is strategic, it's violent, and it's done to continue to operate in a hidden and concealed nature.
And it's really interesting, just to provide a little bit of a context for listeners. When we're talking about INS, we're talking about Immigration Naturalization Services, which was the branch of the federal government that operated this, right, under the Department of Justice. And then later on, INS was changed for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is ICE, and it works under the Homeland Security, the Department of Homeland Security. And I just wanted to put that out there because it's important to understand how these places change and how these places, get transformed into something else. And that's really what's striking about privatized migrant detention, that it changes. It always changes to avoid media scrutiny and public attention and things like that. Like they're purposely trying to avoid being out there in the public. And that is, they change names and locations. There are other ICE contractors, smaller companies that are not these ones. And so it's really complicated to understand the dimension of this network, right? Because ICE has about 250 facilities across the country, but then if we also consider other smaller facilities contracted through local enforcement agencies across the country to a program called 287G, which basically deputizes law enforcement agencies in counties across the country, we're talking about way more than that. We're talking about around 350 facilities. And that without really thinking about these infamous children shelters at the border that are operated by Customs and Border Protection. So what we're talking about is something that is really difficult to grasp, because it's very secularized, it's very spread. So it's complicated to, as Jessica was pointing out, it's difficult to understand the dimension of that. So let's move on to a question that is a little bit more sensible. So what we're seeing right now, what does the detention look like? What is nearby? I mean, we talked about that a little bit, but now let's just like dive into it and describe the things a little bit more. How close can you get to the entrance? Tell me about the architecture, the layout of the detention center. What does this say about civilians? What do you see and don't see? Is something obstructing your visibility? Is that a form of control? Are there places where you can't walk? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I can start with Aurora here. The building of the facility is red. The color of the building is red, and it has a bright red door with some blue trim. And it is kind of sandwiched in between several warehouses. And the street closest to the facility has some graffiti with some, like, BLM signage as well as spray painted fists, so you can tell that there's active protesting of the facility right outside. Today there's lots of cars parked right along the street as well as in the employee staff lot. The entrance has three different flags, and I would say that I could get, you know, as close as the door if I wanted to, but it goes back to what I said about, and you said, about having a purpose. So if I went up there, of course, I would be greeted with a guard asking, you know, what I want, what I am inquiring about. And so that's something to consider, because there are a lot of signs that say don't trespass, and you can't really drive up close to it. And let's see.
Yeah, no, and I think if I could just add something I think that it's gonna be used to prevent movement, so that bystanders, hold on, I think I'm losing connection here. So that bystanders really, you know, like feel watched. So what I'm seeing, and I think that this really has a big contrast with what Jessica is describing. Here, I wouldn't even attempt to cross the parking lot to get closer to the door. The facility is very intimidating in that sense. So what I'm seeing right now is that it's a double fence. Followed by a road that is within the perimeter of the facility, where there are trucks driving back and forth, guards watching. They have been watching me this whole time. And then next to that, there is a little patch of grass, and then the sidewalk. And so I'm standing right on the sidewalk, and next to me on the other side of the road, there is a long fence that is also barbed wire, that is fencing the perimeter of the power plant that is across the street. So there is a sense of different levels of barricades, right? Because if you think about it, the fence that is on the other side of the street, it's also serving the purpose of barricading the perimeter of the facility, right? And on the other side, you have the mountain. So it's a natural barrier. It's a natural limit to be used by the facility to prevent possible escape or any other kinds of observation from outside.
Yeah. And I'll just add for listeners a reminder that both of these are private detention facilities, which is important because they operate outside of the purview of public oversight and accountability. And so I think that's important. I will also let you know that I've made it all the way back. So I've officially finished walking the perimeter. So that's about 23 minutes that it took because of the fencing and parking lots and no trespassing signs. That's how long it takes just to do a square around the facility.
Right. I think that it's also important to just go back very briefly to how these facilities operate, right? Because they are private. So they have private contracts with ICE and United States Marshal Services, which they also, this is another law enforcement agency that works closely with ICE for the detention of unauthorized crossings, undocumented migrants. So these facilities are also divided into pods. And sometimes those pods are not visible from the outside. At the Otay Mesa Detention Center, I can actually see the numbers of each of the pods. And in each of the pods, each of the pods contain a number of detainees. So the capacity of this facility is for 2,000 people. They hold 2,000 people at this facility, 1,200 by ICE, in custody of ICE, and 800 in custody of United States Marshal Services. So that's just, you know, like facts about this prison that are also visible, because I can see the pods, and so I can imagine people living inside of these pods in the prison.
Yeah, I cannot see pods from Aurora. So that is interesting, the difference there.
Yeah, definitely. Aurora has a very different structure. It's constructed in a very different way. If I remember right, there is a drainage river that goes next to the facility, and then the facility uses that. There is a bridge that connects to the parking lot, so it feels kind of like separated from the street.
Right.
So now, kind of like following these questions of sensing and perceiving things, what do you hear? Is it loud or silent? Is it obstructing hearing in a form of control? Just back to the same, rephrasing the same question. What sound would it make if you hit it, if you touch it? Would you be able to break it if you hit it?
It's actually pretty quiet today. I hear some birds, and I mean, I say quiet. I know it was loud for the last 23 minutes when I was walking the perimeter, but now that I'm back really at the front of the facility, I don't hear much. There's a few cars driving. So it's actually really quiet. What about you?
This place is also, it's also definitely quiet because of the placing of it, right? Like you're basically in the desert. But one thing that is really interesting to me is the complicity with the silence, no? And maybe you have something to talk about that as well, because there is a lot about forms of voicing things and communicating things from the outside to the inside and vice versa that creates a solidarity, right? And so not having access to the sound of the place, right? Like all we can hear is the outside, which is peaceful and empty. But what's going inside is something that we're prevented from hearing. And so this goes back to many instances in which activists and advocates and groups have been pushing to have hotlines where detainees can call to report irregularities, right? And so there are cases in this facility at the Otay Mesa Detention Center that a hotline was completely shut down, a hotline that was provided by a Project Amplify to document archive testimonies of migrants and then use that possibly as evidence in court for lawsuits against the U.S. federal government. So there is something important about that part, no? About being able to communicate with the inside and the outside communicating with the outside.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's definitely not accidental. Like we've been saying, all of this is strategic. And what I found in my research, you know, ICE and INS at the time definitely, like, they evolve their systems of power, their apparatus of control. And so all of that is very intentional.
And just to move on to a slightly different question, do any of these observations that we're making about how it looks, how it sounds, the sort of the forms of surveillance and observation and so on, do any of these observations say something about the exploitation of the body, solitary confinement, for example, which is something that has been denounced in many instances, labor, forced labor programs within the facility? So the question is, who is in there? Is everybody in the facility an inmate? And for how long are inmates there? For how long are guards there?
Yeah, so I think that the security, the lack of access, the inside of detention and surveillance is all intentional to conceal, to keep hidden many of the horrors that take place, which include poor medical treatment, physical abuse, the use and overuse of solitary confinement for punishment. And I don't know specifically how long each person is incarcerated, here in Aurora, but I will say that a recent news article from a couple months ago reported that there was a man held here for 925 days, which is a really long time. And so that gives us an idea of some of the people who are detained here for longer periods. Of course, there are much shorter stays. And then people are also transported between different migrant detention facilities. So it's very possible that someone would have spent some time here in Aurora and then be transferred to Otay, right, where you are. In a lot of cases, that happens because incarcerated migrants will protest, will refuse to work, will do something that's seen as deviant or dissenting, and that's strategically used by ICE. So they are quickly apprehended and transported to another facility to quote-unquote solve the problem and to just smash that sign of protest very quickly.
Right, which is something that we have been seeing repeatedly, and usually the argument is the capacity of the facilities, right? That this facility is overflowing with detainees and we have to transport them to a different facility. But in the end, the bottom line of it is that they are basically breaking solidarity. They're like trying to prevent that solidarity among the detainees. So there is always this sense of obscuring and silencing in the operation of the exploitation of the body, right? Because a forced work program, solitary confinement, transferring detainees among facilities, holding them for years, those are all indicative of something that is very complex, right? And so this is just something that we wanted to address as well, sort of like the connections between the exploitation of the body that brings us back to the 1920s, right? And then the connections that are there between that moment that really inaugurated this sense of racism and exclusion to migrants at the border, to what we're seeing with the exploitation of the body in privatized complexes that make millions of dollars.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now moving to kind of like the legal frame of ICE, and this is something that you can actually talk about extensively because you talk about that in your book as well. So ICE detention is a civil and not formally intended to be a punishment for criminal conviction. So we're talking about two different things. These are the detainees here are not imprisoned for criminal conviction. So, but does any you observe make you think otherwise? What is the function of this facility? Is it accomplishing what it's meant to accomplish? Are the detainees charged for the same things? What are the charges? What is the relationship between migrant detention and criminalization?
Yeah, so ICE would argue, and they have for a very long time, like you just said, that the apprehension and detention of migrants is temporary as they await mostly an immigration hearing, right? So they might be apprehended after they've arrived at a border without a visa, if they have a removal deportation order, or if they've missed a prior immigration hearing. But all of these individuals are told that they are merely held for administrative purposes. That is super central to how ICE has tried to hide, obscure, camouflage the real violence that takes place legally and personally for migrant detainees. So I argue that the actual purpose is not administrative. It is to be punitive. It is to be instructive. And this has been the case for decades. From the very moment that immigration detention centers have operated in the United States. They have been extremely violent. They have been used to extract labor from the people they incarcerate, both inside of the facilities as well as in local communities throughout the United States. And they are instructive in the sense that they are trying to manage migration and instill a sense that a certain number of unauthorized migrants will be detained, will be held in horrific conditions, and will be deported. And so that is the managing part of it. But yes, that's just a sharp juxtaposition that exists, which is that the law says, you know, these migrants are not incarcerated, they are not prisoners, and yet they are treated worse than prisoners in so many ways, and all across all of those facilities that you discussed earlier. And so, yes, absolutely, I think it's completely wrong to say that ICE detention is merely administrative and merely civil, and instead we should really see how it is actually functioning and operating, which is to punish people held inside of these places.
It's interesting, just to go back a little bit to what you were mentioning about these sort of like profiling and affecting migrant communities, right? And we think that migrants came, right? These migrants are oftentimes targeted for minor offenses, and that's where the problem really lies in, right? That if they potentially have any encounter with the police, that poses the question, are you a citizen of the United States? And that leads to ICE apprehension right away, right? So you might be driving your car and a cop pulls you over, and then that's it, right? And so this is so like, I just think community. Cop can change. They are in place slowly taking over every part of the country to train cops to perform the duties of an ICE guard, right? And detain people and bring them to these facilities.
Yeah, it's definitely all connected within in the carceral state, absolutely.
About the you know, like the media coverage of it. Can you talk a little bit about what has been out there on the media, in headlines, talking about this detention facility in Aurora? What do we know about the history and operations of it?
Yes, so I'd like to start with the history and then I'll move forward into the more contemporary period. But like I mentioned earlier, GEO was first the Wackenhut Corrections Corporation, and that name didn't change until 2003. And so they began operating the Aurora Immigration Detention Facility, which was one of the earliest private prisons since 1986. And initially, the facility held about 150 migrants, and then it expanded in 1992 to hold about 300 people who were awaiting deportation mostly, but some also had criminal records. And like you were saying earlier, that could include anything from murder to literally spitting on the sidewalk. And so in 2018, an additional annex was added that could hold about 423 beds. And the capacity today is about 1,408 for ICE and about 100 beds for US Marshals. And historically, we know that it's been very exploitative because we have documents and records from people like Roberto Ruiz Hernandez, who in 1992 wrote into the Mexican consulate and was demanding that they help him obtain money that was owed to him for his labor. And this is back in 1992, so we can see the like decades-long struggles of incarcerated migrants here. And then moving forward, there was also a lot of demonstrations. There was one really big one, October 30th of 1992, where 39 incarcerated migrants barricaded themselves inside the Aurora facility. They broke furniture and windows to protest the discipline of one of the prisoners. And as a response, ICE called a SWAT team and canine officers. They used stun grenades, tear gas, and they maced a lot of the incarcerated migrants to suppress the demonstration. Most of those men were Mexican and Cuban, and it was definitely something that was recorded by journalists in the press. However, in 1992, the press made it seem as if those protesting migrants were the troublemakers. They were political, they were radical, they were problem prisoners, as they literally write in those articles. But more currently, there have been, you know, as those atrocious conditions continue, such as negligent medical treatment, sexual violence, migrant deaths, there have been more protests. And so one of the most recent ones is actually a protest from Abolish ICE Denver. In 2020, they camped outside of the detention center for more than 2 months to protest after the first incarcerated migrant reported having a positive COVID-19 test. And so that's just some historical background, which suggests that two things. One, like I've been arguing, these horrible conditions have persisted and lingered decade after decade. But there's also been protests both from incarcerated migrants and the communities as long as those horrible conditions have existed. So that's a little bit of background. Can you say anything about the Otay facility?
I actually have Eliseo? Some... I'm here. I had yes. some technical difficulties for a second, but I'm back. Yes, I would say that unlike the Aurora, which has a really long history, it's been in operation for a while now. It opened in 2015, but before that, it operated in the region. They didn't have their own facility. They didn't own the property, but they rented a sheriff's office. There are, you know, about this facility. This facility was the first facility to report a COVID death inside in ICE custody. And since 2003, 13 detainees have died in the hands of Core Civic, right? Which was not Core Civic back then. Opening this facility, of punishment, right? The forms of abuse. As we were talking about before, forced labor program, Core Civic pays $2 a day to detainees to work for them. So those are the kind of things that I'm able to teach. And there are projects to provide ways to improve the conditions at this facility. One of them is a project that is run by professors at the university, the San Diego State University, which is a correspondence project in which they are possibly to be used in court. So, let's see. So we are broadcasting from two different private prisons. Private prisons. I just want to highlight that. Howard, same as early operate migrant centers, which are also operated by ICE and Homeland Security, but there is no private contractor involved in it.
Yeah, so I think there's actually a lot of similarities between federally run and private prisons. And the similarities are that they're all atrocious. They all include medical neglect, sexual violence, migrant death, like I've been saying. So, for example, the facility that I write about, the El Centro Immigration Detention Camp, was always federally run. It became partly privatized after the 1980s, but it's a good example to compare private prisons to federally operated ones. And they're, like, it's not that one is better than the other. I think the key difference is that private ones can be held a little less accountable, but they operate very similarly. Also, a big difference is the private ones are very much in it for the profit, and so they are trying to cut as much cost as possible. But that also happens in the federally run ones like El Centro, and so I do like to point that out. People sometimes assume that, you know, federally run detention centers are quote-unquote better. Personally, as an abolitionist, to answer the second part of your question, I don't think that that is a question, which is better, which is worse, which is viable, which is financially viable. I think that at the core, the function of all of these facilities is the same, and they cannot operate without violence. Violence is completely embedded into this project. And so, therefore, I don't think we need them. I think they need to be eradicated. I don't think that finances for me is a question. I think the question is, what is the purpose? And if that purpose is to do harm, which it is, then I think that they need to be abolished. What do you think, Eliseo?
Right. And I completely agree. I guess the question, when I'm asking, is it viable, right? Then I'm also sort of asking, is it viable to who? And who is making money? You're right. Is it a good business for what? For which people? And that's kind of like the bottom line of it, that these private prisons operate like businesses, where they have regular people like you and me buying and selling shares in the stock market, right? So these prisons are also in the stock market, and you can buy stocks. And that's kind of like what is really striking about the whole thing, right? That there is people just making a lot of money, like companies with share of stockholders making money out of, you know, fellow humans.
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's just move on to the last question that we have today. So, do you know anything about the conditions in which migrants are held at this place? Have these conditions resulted in any protests? Can you undermine migrant detention centers, eradicate them? Is it possible to do it? What is it? Can we unroot what we planted? Is it a seed or a virus or a germ? What would be the best way to abolish it? Would you work from within or against the infrastructures in place? It is transformable, reformable, or just destroyable?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So, I mean, I think I've been saying this whole hour. The conditions here, specifically at Aurora, are atrocious. The facility has a history of coercing and at times forcing migrants into work, into labor. And so one example that I'll provide is that migrants are often tasked with cleaning the common areas under the threat of solitary confinement. So, for example, there's a case here in Aurora from a few years ago where incarcerated migrants claimed that GEO significantly underpaid them for this work, which already, you said for you in Otay, it's $2 a day. Here, it's $1 a day. And that includes jobs in the kitchen and laundry and other areas. But sometimes they don't even get a dollar a day. Sometimes they are forced to work for free. And so I've called this system that ICE calls a voluntary work labor system. I've called it in my book a forced labor system of exploitation and a way of extracting labor from incarcerated migrants. And so that is how conditions manifest here in Aurora. And in terms of protesting, there's been a lot of protesting all the time, which is nice to see. And then, of course, the biggest example that I gave earlier is from 2020, when activists from Abolish ICE literally camped out here, which was very beautiful to see. They did end that camp out after 2 months. And to get at some of your latter questions, personally for me, I don't think the system can or should be reformed. I think we did not always have immigration detention facilities, camps, concentration camps, whatever term we want to use here. And I don't think that we have to have them. I think that as a historian, that often happens with a lot of apparatuses and systems. Like, we sort of believe that because they've been around for decades, that we can't live and operate or imagine a world without them. But of course we can. And it's very important as historians to remind, I think, people that they didn't always exist. And therefore, it is so imaginable to conceive of a world without them. And so that's my perspective. What about you?
So I think that in the process of, you know, like the struggle to dismantle them and to eradicate them requires a joint effort, right? And so when we're talking about these forms of protest, we have to be thinking about artists, journalists, activists, scholars, historians, politicians, policymakers. Everybody has to be on board, because otherwise it doesn't work. Like, otherwise doing protesting, confronting it, it doesn't really, you know, get to it if it's not a joint effort, right? So we all must be contributing in different ways and fighting in the same trench, perhaps, but with different weapons. And so addressing and denouncing it, protesting it, it's not definitive, of course, but it's, I think that it's one step closer. And then just to get back to the second part of the question, that when I was thinking about this question, I was really thinking about how this place was able to grow that much, right? So thinking about it in terms of a virus, or in terms of a germ, or in terms of a seed, what is it exactly? And then I just wanted to share this note that I had about it, because I feel that it's important to think about it in this way. So we have the soil, and it's fertile, and we can plant anything that we want in it, right? And we decided to plant this stuff, and a lot of people decided to jump on board and take care of it, and we have a huge weed now. And so what we have to do is unroot that weed, but the ground is fertile. The ground is still fertile. We can plant any other thing that we want. So I think that it's just one way in which I was thinking about it, and I wanted to share that.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, so I guess we reached the end of the show. Jessica, do you want to add anything else? Do you have any other questions that you want to pose for listeners, to stimulate listeners to keep thinking about it, perhaps?
Yeah, I do. I actually want to leave listeners with a few questions so that they can reflect on the purpose, the function, the history, the future of migrant incarceration. And so I want to ask you today, if migrant detention facilities could speak, what would they say? What secrets would they reveal? In what language would they speak? Would they be shouting or whispering? Would they be threatening, assertive, hesitant, afraid? That's all.
Thank you so much, Jessica. Thank you so much for being with us, for chatting with us for an hour. Thank you, August and Wave Farm, for hosting the show. And thank you to all our listeners. Stay safe. Take care.
Thank you.